Welcome, everybody. It's Charlie and Kelly, and we are here. Well, we were just sorting out where we are. I'm in Seattle. Charlie's in Massachusetts. And where are you exactly in Massachusetts anyway?
Well, I'm in the guest room of our house in Northampton, Massachusetts, having just come down from Vermont, where I was for the weekend getting a suntan. That's not where you usually would go, but when you go to an ultimate frisbee tournament for the whole weekend and sit in the sun, you get pretty tanned. So I just got back about an hour ago from a weekend up in northern Vermont near the Canadian border. It was beautiful.
Wow. That's fabulous. Well, yeah. I did the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder has been working with a PR firm, and they got a gig on Katie Couric's show, The Katie Show. And
I wondered what you sent an email. I didn't know what you meant. Oh, you went on the Katie Couric show?
I did. It was really a very interesting experience. I'd never done anything like that before.
Yeah.
And the purpose of the show, it was Glenn Close, and actually more importantly, at least from my perspective, sorry about the phone there, more importantly from my perspective was the fact that it was her family members, and they were talking about charity, Bring Change to Mind. But it's really about reducing the stigma of mental illness.
Mm.
And so Jessie, I don't know her last name, but Glenn Close's sister,
mm-hmm.
meets criteria for bipolar disorder. And then the nephew meets criteria for schizoaffective disorder. And it was really, for me, it was just a really moving experience to hear them talk about what it's like for them. Anyway, so that's I just the way the conversation went, I didn't get to make many of the remarks I'd hoped to make about stigma and what to do about it. Just the conversation kind of went a different direction. And so that's my idea would be to follow up on some of that and discuss stigma, mental illness, shame, just sort of what the impacts of all that are. And so that's the direction I would go. Does that work?
That sounds great. That sounds like a really good idea. I didn't know that. You know, you wrote in an email that you did the Katie Couric thing for NEA BPD, and then I thought, what did you pretend you were Katie Couric somewhere, or you know, in some sort of conference they were having?
I don't know, Charlie.
No, this was the real thing.
I did not look that good in a white dress, let me tell you.
And I have seen Glenn Close and her sister on videos talking before. It was very moving to me too.
It was. I think that was what was most moving. It was the courage. And I get that. Mm-hmm. So that's really what I wanted to maybe even just start with is stigma.
Good.
I went ahead and looked it up because I was very interested in what does stigma actually mean. And it's interesting because if you look at the dictionary definition, it actually means a mark, like having been branded. And there's something so poignant and powerful about that idea that there's something that marks you as different, and not just different, but defective, you know, to be ostracized or treated, you know, kept away because there's something wrong or dangerous with you. And the way it's talked about now in the research literature is, you know, of course, more specified. They talk about it having three parts, stereotypes, so if we think about mental illness, you know, stereotypes about how people who have mental illness are, prejudice, which is when a person endorses those stereotypes as true, and then discrimination, the actual behavioral reactions like withholding help or not associating or not renting to somebody, not hiring them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really, when I was thinking about it, you know, sort of the mental, what are the stereotypes of about mental illness, and how is mental illness portrayed in the media, for example?
Mm-hmm.
I think that when I was looking, I did a pretty good lit search here, and there's some actually fabulous work being done on this. But the three stereotypes that seem to be most prominent are that people with mental illness are violent, you know, scary, prone to violence.
mm-hmm.
That they're childlike, you know, you should marvel at their qualities,
mm-hmm.
and or that they're weak in character. And so, you know, you're dangerous, you're blameworthy, or you're incompetent if you have these. And what was interesting to me as I was looking at this is when, you know, it's the sort of idea of either being mad or bad, that there's a way where either you're defective or something like wrong. And even attempts to, some of the more recent attempts to medicalize, you know, oh, it's a brain disorder, and sort of make it more palatable somehow, end up, the research that was showing that that can inadvertently end up making it seem like you have less of a good, less good prognosis, because it's stable, you know, it's a brain disorder. How would you ever change that?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this mm-hmm. idea of being mad or that you're bad, that in fact, and this was really interesting to read about, that mental illness, at least in Western cultures, is viewed as something that you are actually more responsible for than physical illness. That that they're really different, and that mentally ill people could actually do something about it to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore there's more anger and distaste. So I'll just stop there for a second, but just see, you know, do you have thoughts or even reactions just about that?
Well, it's already a lot. What I was thinking when you brought up stigma that goes very much along with this is that my experience in my work with the Department of Mental Health, with all sort of severe and persistent mental illness, is the degree, and as well as in the work with borderline personality disorder, the degree, I think it's good to tease this out the way you're doing, because it is so thoroughly part of how we think,
mm-hmm.
that it's like all trying to describe water when you're swimming in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really everywhere. It's so, and I think when you say that it's this, what do you say? It's sort of like a mark or a brand. I was thinking like
mm-hmm.
a stain. It's like,
mm-hmm.
it's like, what if the world was made up of 10 people and two of them, have some kind of, characteristics that in that group of 10 are seen as undesirable for one reason or another, through no fault of their own. They just have these characteristics. And let's say that two or three people kind of label them and spread it further as if it's like more than just sort of these characteristics that came about somehow and may have come about even through a transactional process with those people. And then there they are, and so everybody, all 10 people, gradually participate in the process of this thing that at first is just a characteristic and later is like an internally experienced defect or stain or badness or madness. And it's like, and then the ones that are silent are contributing to it. And the ones that are aggressive about it contribute to it, and the ones that really name it. And then gradually the people that are labeled take it in, and that the context they're in gives them little alternative after a while. Very few alternatives at first to just kind of like start to assume that this must be true.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a disaster, Kelly, the way you're putting it, because then you start to lose reputation. You start to lose social opportunities. You start to lose jobs and vocational opportunities. You start to lose money. And then all of that gets there too, and it's as if all of that reinforces the original stigmatization.
Exactly.
And until it's all so thoroughly part of the world, these are just 10 people, and it's almost easier to see how that would happen with 10 people, but, you know, when it's part of the whole world, like, nobody takes responsibility for it.
Yeah. That process of, I really like that, what you were just saying, the powerfulness of it and the way we all participate. The self-stigma was the other thing I was reading about, and the way in which, in the same exact way that you might have stereotypes, that you might endorse those, but that the process of self-stigmatization actually ends up preventing the person from, it's not just fear of rejection, although that's a big one. Like if you were to come out and you were to describe, you know, I have borderline personality disorder, or I have bipolar disorder, that you'll be rejected. You know, people will not let you stay, or you hear voices. You know, it really does make a difference. Like you can't rent a house. You can't get safe housing. You know, like the degree to which it has an impact from others rejecting is one thing, and so the ways that you would then hide or not speak freely, but then the ways you would forego opportunities, you would choose not to marry, for example, or who you would even consider as a possibility for a mate or to date or to approach. You know, you would not go after certain types of jobs. So I think the self-stigmatization and all the ways that those stereotypes get perpetuated. It's not always, it was interesting, one of the people I was reading was saying that self-stigmatization doesn't only lead to lower self-esteem, the kind of a why try effect, you know? They're just going to think the worst of me, why try? It also, in some contexts, leads to a righteous anger and a much more active advocating and fighting for one's rights or against the injustice of being stigmatized. But but often that's the same person will be doing both. You know, it's not like it's almost always a mixed bag, is the way it was looking when people were describing it.
So, there you're talking about something that I wonder more what you mean. When you say self, first of all, is self, when you use the words and when you've read about self-stigmatization, how close is that to what in DBT we call self-invalidation?
This is interesting. So I would say it's self-invalidation is a self-stigma usually means exactly the same as stigma addressed toward the self, so that you hold stereotypes about what it means. You have prejudice, you endorse those stereotypes, and in essence, you behave as if it's all true. So, you know, that because you have mental illness, you won't be able to change. It's a brain disorder, therefore you won't have a good prognosis or something like that. I think of self-invalidation as a broader you know, like self-stigma, you might judge yourself for having mental illness, but self-invalidation could be much broader. You could judge yourself about a lot of things. Does that make sense, or does that fit how you would think about it?
No, I think it does. I think that what I was interested to, I do think that self-invalidation can be about almost anything. I mean, if you've had the life experience in a pervasively invalidating environment of feeling yourself to be, disregarded, dismissed, ignored, pathologized about almost anything, then that sort of aspect of your identity or of yourself or of your self-construct can take on that flavor. At first you might defend it, you might fight it, but you're fighting it from the position of trying to almost like get it out of you, reject it. And then I think you're putting up the good fight, but it really is relentless, because if you put up a good fight, even if you advocate for yourself, you can bring on further invalidation or stigmatization. Oh, that's just an angry person who doesn't accept this or that, and so it can really be so. It's sort of like, how do you get out of this mess once it's there? It's so hard. I had a patient of mine and in the departmental health a few years ago was talking to me. He had, a psychotic disorder. And he was saying that when you go to hospitals, he was very articulate about it and very dear and very pained about just exactly what we're talking about. And he said, when you go to hospitals and you sit around in groups and they ask you, well, tell me about yourself. He said, if you were Michael Jordan, with a mental illness and you were in a hospital and you said something like, and I play basketball, people might say, oh, that's nice. In other words, once you are stigmatized, it's almost it requires a paradigm shift for someone to think that you also are really talented, genuinely, and that this affliction, this thing you're afflicted with, which is actually partly maybe brain, but it's partly behavioral, is partly also transactional with the world. I mean, borderline personality disorder, at least the way I think about it, is a transactional disorder. Mm-hmm. It isn't just a person that comes down with this. I mean, it's a context that helps generate it in a person, and a person manifests it. But so he was very articulate in many ways. That was just one example, and how it starts to be assumed that you're incapable. Everywhere you go, every second of your life, you go somewhere and someone either is kind to you but acts like you're incapable, or else they're not so kind to you and they insult you and they assume you're incapable. But the common thread everywhere is, oh, you have this kind of mental illness. All right, well, I guess we can't, like you said, the stereotypes are automatic and deep, that you're mad or you're bad or you're going to be dangerous. Or you're incompetent. That other one you said about childlike is very interesting, because it's almost like the kind version of stigmatization is to highlight the...
Yeah.
It's what?
But just as patronizing.
Yeah, it's patronizing. It's like romanticizing something that... Mm-hmm. And it is patronizing. So it's...
It's very hard. It makes me, so one of the other things I was reading about is, obviously nobody wants to do harm to another person by endorsing stereotypes, by actually being prejudiced.
Right.
You may not, stereotypes are forming these sort of templates that just make sense of the world more quickly. They're more efficient, like brains are wired for pattern recognition. And to make, like groupings and comparisons and that. So there's a certain way where the stereotypes will simply form based on the media and what you're exposed to. But it's this prejudice, like nobody wants to then endorse it, believe it, act from it sort of in a oblivious sort of way. But it turns out that suppression, like trying not to think that way, actually backfires. And in the same thought suppression, this idea of rebound effect, if I tell you not to think about a white elephant and its trunk is just now reaching over your shoulder, you'll start to think it. And so there's this way that...
So what would be the equivalent in this situation as don't think about a white...
So if you try yourself not to think about the stereotypic, that a person is not prone to violence or they don't have a weak character, they're not blameworthy, like any of those, you try not to think about people that way. It's bad to think that way. You try to suppress it. That actually activates the stereotype. It's almost like your brain then goes into monitoring, are you or aren't you thinking that way? And it actually perpetuates the type of, it strengthens in some ways the stereotypes. So I think that some of the moralistic ways we might educate, or the more strident ways we might come at people, protest against, may or may not actually be effective if what they end up doing is shaming or setting off that type of reaction in the person who is doing the stigmatizing.
Mm-hmm.
Including mm-hmm. ourselves, the way that we might treat ourselves, like we don't want to treat ourselves that way, but suppression is probably not the way out. Does that make sense, or
is it, that clear? You know, I'm trying to really get my mind around it. It makes what I'm trying to do is plug in concrete situations where, let's say I know somebody. There's actually a boy in our community where it's become publicly known that he has depression and that he had made a suicide attempt. And everybody has shared that observation. It was in some sort of partially disguised way. It was in the newspaper, but then it's also been discussed around. And actually the boys that I took to an ultimate frisbee tournament in Vermont this weekend were talking about it. And everybody's talking about it in a way that is, you'd have to say, is a concerned and I think kind and compassionate about him. But there is this quality, and this is where I think that it goes from the recognition of an objective, some kind of characteristic or situation that could use some kind of like attention or help. And then, but it's talked about in a way that this is the way that you said is kind of romanticized or moralistic. Oh, we're all so good now. And, you know, myself included, just hear it as I think about it from this point. You know, there is at the same time, there's something that creeps into one's awareness or into one's language without awareness at first of, oh, so he has depression and he has made a suicide attempt. And then you extrapolate from there without knowing anything. Your mind extrapolates like about him. And, you know, it's like spreading something with a broad brush when you hear somebody has a disorder, a diagnosis, an event, a reputation, and it gets spread so that it's much broader than that. And I think it loses all objectivity, even when we're compassionate, and it loses precision, and in a way it loses compassion because we don't realize you're sort of relegating the person to a different status. And things get very muddied and blurry, and you don't, you know, people avoid that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think this boy will probably be avoided by some people, and other people will probably make him a cause. But there's something in the middle of all of this of just precisely compassionately recognizing, okay, this is the reality of his situation. Let's not be silent, and let's not perpetuate it. But then that's where I'm interested, Kelly, in, like, obviously, if you've given this much thought and you went on this Katie Couric thing and with Glenn Close and her sister, I mean, I'd be interested what kind of thoughts you've been having or coming across about what helps.
Yeah.
I mean, what about just sort of elements that help address stigma and self-stigmatization, which is, you know, once stigma's in place and self-stigma's in place, if it's like self-invalidation, it doesn't take much to keep it going.
Exactly, yeah. I would say maybe we could even chunk the discussion into self, and then, you know, what do you do for others at a personal level, maybe within a family or your extended social network, and then all the way up to a societal level, like what should we be doing to advocate for different types of media and different types of explanations of disorder, of difficulty, of disability that might allow a person, exactly like the situation we're just describing, to retain their dignity and not be labeled in a way that then perpetuates stigma. So just to maybe follow from, you know, at a personal level, it's really interesting because I looked hard, and, you know, there's not a lot of research to inform inform what you would do at a personal level toward others, like accept contact. And it's pretty interesting that when they talk about contact as a way to reduce stigma, the idea is that people with a disorder or whatever the difference is would spend time with people who are, you know, the in-group versus the out-group. They would spend time together. But what matters a lot for the stereotype to change is that people need to be at a peer level. You know, you need to be actual equals in the interaction. It's useful if there's whatever that interaction is actually allows the person who is the person who has a disorder in this case to break the stereotype, to deviate from it.
Mm-hmm.
Others where you make contact with the fact that they actually are a better basketball player than you.
Mm-hmm.
They're a better mother than you. You know, they're a better cook, flower gardener, you know, like to really get how much more there is to a person than a label.
Mm-hmm.
So it matters that you're equal, that you have a chance to experience something that disconfirms, you know, really shows you competence, for example, really shows you the person is not dangerous, you know, stuff like that. And then the other is that it can be really helpful if there's some way that it's a goal-directed activity, that it's something where you're doing something, moving towards something together. So I thought that was really interesting, and I found this is just, you know, straight my own experience this last week. I went around and I bought my fancy clothes, because who knows what you wear when you go on national TV.
Didn't somebody tell you what to wear?
I'll tell you, I hit up all my friends who've done this before, and then, of course, my almost 13-year-old had lots of opinions. But as I went around, you know, and help having different clerks and whatever help me shop and put stuff together and that, you know, they would ask, so what's this for? And I would explain. And I'd say, you know, it's about mental illness and reducing stigma. And immediately what would then happen is they would say, oh, you know, my mother or my sister
exactly.
Or my
exactly
a good friend of mine or a guy I went to college with. And the stories start. And the thing I did was I just said, you know, what's that like for you? And then I listened. And and one of the people I ran into said, yeah, I really struggle with hearing voices. I don't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pause, if you say something really as simple as, yeah, I heard this really interesting thing about mental illness and stigma, and it made me start to think about how many people are affected, you'd be amazed at how many people will then say something. And then if you just ask that one follow-up, you know, what's that like for you? It starts to break the taboo about talking about it. And it makes, at least this is one of the really interesting things I was reading about, is the connection between stigma, shame, and loneliness. This fear of being rejected, but also the actual rejection being the most damaging aspect of stigma. And so this ability to break the silence. If you ask, you know, like some of the research actually says, people will choose not to live by, you know, say there's a halfway house, you know. You don't want to live by a halfway house. You don't want people to be placed in your neighborhood. You know, if you're saying, would you allow your son or daughter to marry or be a partner with, you know, somebody who met criteria for some psychiatric disorder. No, you'd rather not. So, like, actual rejection. If you come out at work, you know, and you say something more about what you struggle with, the ways you won't get certain, you know, you won't get that big account where the stress is going to be higher. It just won't be offered to you. I think there's a real rejection. It's not just the fear of rejection.
Oh, no, it's a real rejection. And it's a real, it seems to me when I've seen it, and I guess it's, you know, it's because of the kind of work I do in the Department of Mental Health, it's just constant focus. I mean, and it's just, you see it. And with my patients, I just see it so pervasively. The level of rejection is constant, and a lot of the rejection you don't even think of as rejection because it's so thoroughly pervasive. It's just like the way people avoid you or don't say anything back to you when they ordinarily would, or they don't challenge you about something when they would with someone else, or they won't ask you, well, what are you doing this summer? Because they're afraid of what they're going to hear. And so it creates an abnormal environment all the time. And so what I like about what you're saying is, and I think it has been, I guess, my experience, so I don't, you know, there's a whole world of stigma. There's conferences on stigma that I'm well aware of. I've been to a couple over the years, but there are such experts on stigma that I consider myself an amateur observer about this, but it's constantly there. And the idea that contact perpetuates it and contact can make a difference in it, I think is true. Not just sort of famous people coming out about disorders, but that is one thing. I just think there's a lot. I think there's just a lot of things that make a difference. The media portrayals, I hope you're going to get back to, but the actual person-to-person contact probably carries more weight. Because let's say you're somebody who doesn't have much contact and you've avoided it, and suddenly you have a friend or a family friend of a family member or something that you're talking to, and you realize, oh, it just breaks down all the stigmas too, especially if you've had a number of contacts, and that's really hard to get. And even, by the way, Kelly, I was thinking about those, when you do have contact with people, it doesn't necessarily break it down. It kind of depends on what kind of experience there is, because just the way, you know, the treatment, just the way the use of exposure and treatment works. I mean, you can sort of expose yourself to something, but actually if you don't fully let it in, if you hide from it, escape from it, or avoid part of it, it can perpetuate it. So it's really difficult. It almost requires structured, helpful opportunities to do the kind of contact you're talking about. So, because as soon as, let's say you just run into somebody on the street or in a bus ride, and you learn, oh, I have manic depressive illness, or I have schizophrenia. I mean, if somebody were to dare to say these things, or I have borderline personality disorder, then you're having contact. But what you do with that right then? Most people are going to start doing weird things. They're not going to treat it like someone else they sit next to on a bus and say, oh, what do you do for a living? Or, oh, where do you live? Or, oh, that's interesting. No, they're going to say, oh, you have borderline personality disorder. Oh, okay. How are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Already, it's very hard to get out of it.
Yeah.
It's a very challenging problem. You get very awkward, and then that gets conveyed. But but the person with the who's stigmatized is actually more used to it than you are, and they sometimes act in a way that perpetuates the stigma, because what choice do they have? In a casual situation, it's very hard.
Yeah, I think. Well, so that's,
we need
that's
camps
where I would
and
go.
Workshops on changing this problem. We need to have
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, this is the kind of problem where when you really put your mind to it, you realize, of course, this is what NEA BPD is trying to do constantly about borderline personality disorder, with education and contact and people coming out and you doing what you did.
Yeah. Well, this, I think, just following up on it, I agree with you completely. At the individual, at our, you know, at a personal level, the integrity and thought that has to go into what is the correct response, you know, like what, and I tend to think about it as what maintains the other person's dignity, privacy, you know, is respectful, and what increases my understanding? Because if I really understand something, mm-hmm. always next comes empathy. You know, I mean, like if I get it, then right next to it, you know, like what's up with that person, then I'll understand. Even if the behavior is, you know, I'm trying to understand something that irritated me or put me out. If I really get where they're coming from, I'll be, mm-hmm. I might still be mad, but I would also have empathy for where they were coming from. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, like it, even just figuring out, like, so you hear about somebody who did have a suicide, you know, they're depressed and had a suicide attempt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what is the right, where's the correct stance with that?
You know, what if somebody, like, instead of having a suicide attempt, you heard that they made a trip to South Africa, and then you were sitting with them in a way that you wouldn't even hesitate, and you wouldn't worry,
mm-hmm.
you would say, what was it like in South Africa, or what did you do there? And you would get the whole story, or, you know, to whatever degree you want the whole story, but that it would be natural. But what happens if somebody had a suicide attempt? I mean, it seems like what I wish happened would be you would say, oh, my God, you know, is that something? What happened? What happened? You know, and if you got the story, and sometimes I think stigma gets undone when you really hear somebody's story or the story of their family and what they all went through. Mm-hmm. And once you get the story, it becomes a human story rather than just sort of like a frightening piece of news makes you extrapolate with this broad brush. And so I think it does help to break it down a little bit when you really get the nodal points of a story, and you say, oh, my God, that could have been me. That could have been my brother. That could have been my son. You know, mm-hmm. All these things, it's like, oh. Mm-hmm. I think that bridging those gaps is just really important.
Or hospitalized, you know. All the people who have to figure out how will they cover that so many year history in their resume.
What am I going to say if I go out with someone on a date and they say, what have you been doing? Or if on a job interview.
Yeah. And then family members, you know, how do you explain, how do you really talk about it in a way that maintains your dignity and not being, I think there's something about the way one talks about vulnerability. And this is the part where I think all of us can actually do something that makes a difference also is finding ways to talk about our own vulnerability, weaknesses. We had that thing on foibles and quirks, you know, like...
Yeah, I was
really
thinking of that too.
Just finding ways, and I'm not saying I'm fantastic at this. I feel like it's something that it's really hard to actually talk about vulnerability where you're really weak, you know, or where things really did not go well. And do it in a way that where you feel like you're standing on the ground, you know, you are in a place of self-compassion. You understand the facts of it, you know. You're not ashamed, or that isn't the main quality. You know that the main quality is one of kindness and understanding. I think there's something about being able to cultivate that capacity. And really get, why is it different if it's physical illness versus mental illness in my own mind, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and to look, oh, that person has cancer. Oh, that person just had a manic episode and ended up in the hospital. You're like, mm-hmm. what's really different? What comes up that's different about that?
Well, I think my mind was going the same direction about this, that this is the kind of thing that before you're running around trying to change attitudes about stigma, it really is a very personal thing, and that you might change more attitudes about stigma if you actually are honest with yourself about your own experiences. I mean, I've been stigmatized over my lifetime sometimes. I've been with a lot of people who are stigmatized. I've had family members that are stigmatized. And, you know, if you really just stop there, you've already got so much to think about and just to come clean with and to be honest about and to be, you know, look at the judgments. I just turned 64 a few days ago, and I kidded about it a lot. I even wrote a song about it, as you can imagine, since I write a song about everything. So I wrote a song because I started kidding, and I did this in a class I was doing online, and I did it at work, too, where I was saying, you know, the big problem with turning 64 is that now I can no longer legitimately sing the song from the Beatles when I'm 64, because now I'm 64, and now I'll never be able to sing it again. I was kidding about that. But, you know, I think what I was contending with and have been contending with is there's something about, you know, being around that age and then that song, I think, oh, no, what are people going to think about me? And I've almost overexposed it, even maybe right now. I mean, and I think I'm uncomfortable with it. I'm uncomfortable with the societal attitudes that come with it, even with somebody who's, you know, known to be, you know, thought to be good at what he's doing. And so I kid about memory, I kid about this, and the song I wrote was to give myself a new extension from the When I'm 64, it's called When I'm 92. And did I not send that to you?
I haven't seen that.
I don't have it in front of me, or I would do a quick singing of it here, but it really is about how, you know, will you still stay with me? Will you still listen to me? Will you still talk with me when I'm 92? Mm. You know, when I'm drooling, when I don't remember things, when I might go missing for a while, will you still think of me? And it's sort of a touching idea in the song, as many Beatles songs. It's actually a beautiful song they wrote. And when I looked back at it, and there's a whole stigma, of course, attached to that, too. So I've almost overexposed it. You know, I'm not going to go around perpetuating the stigma about it in myself by not saying anything about it. But then on the other hand, it's hard to get out of it. Even when you do say something, even when you write a song, even when you talk about it seriously or humorously, and that's nothing compared to my patients that have coped with, you know, I had a patient with borderline personality disorder. She met the criteria very fully for many years, and she got a lot better. And she came in one day, and this was a lot at 10, 15 years ago, and said, do I still have borderline personality disorder? And I said, well, you know what? Technically, that's just a matter of, like, looking at the criteria. You want to look at the criteria with me? Yeah, let's look. So we look at the criteria, and you know you have to meet 5 criteria out of 9 in DSM-4. And so we counted them up, and she didn't quite meet 5 anymore. She met, like, 4. And she said, so I don't have it anymore. I said, that's right. She said, okay, would you change my diagnosis? Like, what do I have now? It was interesting. I mean, and it meant so much to her. It was a very moving conversation. What do I have now? And the other thing that was really interesting is at the end of that conversation, she said, I would like you to write a letter to everyone who ever worked with me, and all the hospitals I've been to, and all the emergency room doctors, and the social workers and the case managers that I've had, and the community residences, and inform them that I no longer have borderline personality disorder. It was a real great moment. I mean, she was like, sort of, you could just feel from the inside out, she was trying to move out of or get or expunge or I can't think of the word, you know, discharge all of that sense of self-hatred and self-doubt and self-incompetence and self-stigma that comes with just having the label, you know. And she had made real gains in her life, and she wanted it to be codified You know, and I did, and I wrote a letter, and she made a list of everybody she wanted to receive it, and it meant a lot to her.
That's cool. What a cool move she made. It makes me think of this other site that I came across as I was prepping. It's called Hearing Voices. It's from the UK. Have you seen this? It's a phenomenal.
I haven't seen that site, but we have Hearing Voices groups all over the place. I mean, there are people, you know, that's very common in public mental health now, and they're really good. They're helpful.
Really good. People, if people are interested, you might, if you've ever had hallucinations, you know, or delusions, or that site is, I think it does a beautiful job of.
I don't know the site, Kelly. What is it? Hearingvoices.com.
It's hearingvoices.com or org. I think it might be org. It's a UK site. I'll see if I can't get that link to Perry afterwards. But to me, it's a really nice example of what would be. It's not mad. It's not bad. It's a way of explaining, back to your 10 people. It's a way of explaining a difference where it just stays a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And where what's really emphasized is self-empowerment, autonomy, making meaning. And I think of people who are, you know, you can label it as one of the criteria for a disorder, you know, like the kind of exuberance or the emotional intensity or lability, you know, but they're really important aspects of what might get labeled disorder. They're actually, you know, your real experience of them is it's you. It's not disordered. It's how you are. You know, it may make people uncomfortable. It may cause you problems in your own life, but it's not like this move of being able to own and sort out for yourself, like, what does it actually mean to have this type of characteristic, whatever it is?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that site was just a really nice example of, I think, finding language and ways of explaining. So there's another one I was just thinking about for both family members and also people who meet criteria, who have a label, you know, imposed on them, is to find your own way of explaining what's up with that you can hold your head up about, you know, that actually, you know, even hospitalizations, even like long stretches of crazy whacked out behavior where you look back and you think, damn, I wish I had not, you know, whatever extreme thing it was, you know, to be able to figure out how can you explain that.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that is true, but you can feel some dignity about. Or you can feel ashamed. Like, I wish I had not been addicted and done these things. But like with the spirit of really owning it and making sense of it. What are you thinking?
Well, I was just thinking about, you know, one of the projects that I've been involved in that I think has been helpful for a fair number of people with this is, forget if I've mentioned it before in any of these Connecting the Dots series, but I think you know about it because it with my colleague nurse Ro Karparas, the people there, which is for people on the phone who don't know what I mean, this is a project where we've taken DBT skills and. I was concerned that all the money that goes into training people to do DBT, often then they, whether it's in private practices or in clinics, it often ends up being used only for the people who really are at the higher functioning range of the problem. And then other people can't even get into those groups who have some of the same, you know, behavioral problems. So we set out to do something about that in our area when I was the area medical director of our Department of Mental Health in Western Massachusetts and set up groups where Ro, who's always been great at peer-to-peer education, really going back to health education about smoking and sexuality and eating and nutrition and all kinds of things, she started teaching. We set up a model where she would co-teach groups with somebody who had borderline personality disorder as a diagnosis and who had been through DBT skills at least a couple of times. And then with the idea that they would be great teachers of it and very credible teachers, that they were using the skills. And even if they're still themselves going sometimes in and out of a hospital or they're having still difficulties, still they could be quite credible teachers. And they would be and Roe would pair with them, and then they would teach groups of people. They'd go to hospitals, they'd go to residential programs, they'd go to clubhouses and day programs, anyone that would take them. And she's taught, she along with her various individuals who've been through DBT and have been her co-teachers have probably taught 600 or 700 people by now in our area. Mm. 9-10 session skills groups and sometimes doing it again. And the most interesting thing of all of the project so far, I think, has been the impact on the people doing the teaching. We may know more about that because they teach one group with her, and then they learn more, and then they teach another group, and then she sort of takes the back seat, and they take the front seat of the teaching. Those people have, it's really combating stigma as well as just starting to turn the problems they've had on their ear to be like competencies. They go in and be able to describe, you know, oh yeah, I did such and such, you know, when I was really wanting to die and there was nobody there for me and I couldn't think of one more thing to do. And then I went and I went back to those skills, and then I tried just going out for a walk in the woods and lying on my back and looking up at the sky and trying to just be in that moment. And you know what? It totally changed me. And then when someone who did it like that explains it in a like, oh, this is just life, you know, and then people say, oh, I could do that. And also this person is still somebody who's having some of the troubles, but they're getting more and more competent. So that's a real powerful thing when it works, is for people to not just do advocacy, but also to get right down. And I think it's cool. Even some people think, well, why do you need a professional to be part of that? But and that's a reasonable discussion to have, but it's been kind of cool that they pair with her, with Roe, and that Roe also discloses things about herself. And there's this feeling of, you know what? Competence and problems can go right hand in hand.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, you know, with problems also has competencies, and everybody with competencies has problems. It sort of breaks down this idea that there's the incompetent ones, the mad ones, the bad ones, and the violent ones over there. And then there's the others over here that are looking over there saying, oh, we should do something about them, either compassionately or not so compassionately. So there must be a million projects like this in the world that, you know, just you and I don't even know about, but
yeah, it'd be cool to hear about them. It makes me think of one of the things I did in prepping was I asked all of my friends who are therapists if they'd be willing to ask their clients, you know, what do you wish people knew? What is it that you don't talk about but wish people knew about what it's like? Mm. And I think there were a lot of very poignant and just beautiful things that people said and shared, but the one that stood out to me is, the person said, it's like having a mental illness, a mental disorder. It's like wearing a bomb vest that could go off at any time, you know, sense of relapse at any time. But nobody will help you. You know, people really stand back. And if it was for any other reason besides mental illness, they'd rush in and try to get the vest off you.
Oh, that's such an amazing statement.
Yeah.
You mean because people won't rush in and help you because they're afraid they'll detonate the vest themselves? I mean, in the metaphor, they're afraid it's going to be dangerous for them too.
Exactly. Whereas if it was something physical, you know, there would be less hesitation. And I think all the things we've talked about, but the other, you know, higher order one is that I just wasn't aware of until doing this prep is just how few good examples there are in the media.
Yeah, share some things about that.
So the thing that was really, what you just said actually is what's making me think about it. It's this ability to portray a person who has whatever the difficulties are in their fullness, not as a disorder. You know, you're not the label, but you're actually a person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even mental health people who have a lot of education, you can give lip service to it, but to really get it, you know, that it's a person first. You know, so I was just, I went through and I just watched, have you seen Silver Lining Playbook yet?
I've seen it, yeah. I saw it a few months ago and when it very, very first came out. And I'm wanting to watch it again, in fact, because people keep talking about it. So what did you notice? What struck you about it?
What I loved, I actually really enjoyed a lot of that, the way that things were portrayed in that. I think the main characters were people, at least I just loved them both.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw the main character, Pat, who struggles with bipolar symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And real problems with anger at times. You see him lose it, and you see him rally in ways that are remarkable, you know, that you'd
mm-hmm.
feel proud of if you did yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it also portrayed the really intense ways that you get into it as a family about worrying about the person's ability to control and manage their symptoms, the ways that you doubt, the way that you're over-controlling, and the ways that you stand fast and defend them. Just there was something about, there's a couple of scenes with Robert De Niro in particular where, you know, you see him trying to make sense of it all and be there. And I just feel like there's a way where,
mm-hmm.
however we work through stigma, it's not easy on either party's sides to do it. It's such a transaction of how, you know, how do you build trust? How do you actually see the person's competence? How do you work that all through to get there? So
you know,
I liked
point.
That maybe a lot.
I'd like to see that again, but I think what you're describing is this breakthrough experience where rather than being put off by or concerned about a label, or a disorder or something, when you get into it and you see the fullness, I mean, of the person who, what their life was like before they had that, and then what their life was like when that came into being and coping with that. Recently working with a family that where somebody just started to have signs of schizophrenia for the first time at a usual age for that. And they're all reeling. It's all so painful and confusing. And they get all this mixed signals from the mental health community about it. And they're such human beings coping with it, as is always the case when you get in close.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's rare to have a movie that does that, isn't it? I mean, there's Academy Award-winning movies that, you know, are romanticizations of either mental illnesses or autistic disorders or whatever. And it's touching. They have touching scenes and stuff. But it isn't like it isn't the reality.
Yeah.
Including the amazing competencies that come up in the middle of the night when you're trying to make it through and a family member gets up with you. Stuff like that. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God, we're just barely touching on something that's so huge. I'm so glad you brought it up. But it's it also feels like tip of an iceberg.
It does. It feels and this is definitely one of those conversations where, you know, if any listeners have feedback that they want to shoot to any ABPD the email address, that would be really fantastic. I think the whole process of prepping and doing this thing
Yeah.
It sensitized me and in some ways radicalized me in a way I wasn't before.
Yeah. I hear it.
I got clear how important it is to actually, you know, come out, so to speak, make it safe for people to come out, create conditions for that, and way more aware of the isolation and loneliness that comes when you can't talk about something.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really, I feel such gratitude for, you know, there was the celebrity aspect, but I actually felt most moved by the two people who were willing to come out on the on the program that we did.
You know, it's very amazing, and we could have another many shows on things like this. I mean, Angelina Jolie, what she just came out and explained, is setting off a lot of attitude adjustment, people thinking about things. But getting to know these personal levels like you're describing, I think really is huge. I know it's time to stop, so let me say more thing that just follows off something you said. I just want to say this to anyone who's still listening, is that in the course of preparing for this one, an email came to Perry Hoffman, came to NEABPD about this topic when somebody heard that this was going to be the topic. And I hope we've helped. I hope we addressed it a little bit, the person's thoughts and questions. But I want to make a broader point that when you do learn what our topic is going to be, and if it's a topic that's really personally important to you, and if you want to contact NEABPD's email address and say, you know, what you're interested in about it, or either to give input or else just to ask us, you know, hoping that we'll address some things, please do, because it, you know, we just respond to what is in front of us about these things. And so if we get emails about these things, then we're going to try to address them. So please do.
Yeah, I found that email really helpful. That was fantastic.
Yeah, me too. Okay, it's actually just past 9 on the East Coast, so you probably need to go eat dinner. On the
I
West
do.
Coast.
It's that time. Well, good night. Always good talking to you.
Yeah, you
good
too.
Good night, all.
Take care. Good night, all. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.